We're back about 20 minutes into hour two, and I don't know what it is about the calendar. I don't know. It just so happens that the 20th of January falls on a Wednesday this year, and Sid, for whatever reason, you and I, here we are again on a fairly momentous day.
Yeah, I mean, you can't make it up.
Well,
by the way, I enjoyed your segment before with Emily Gullickson, because, it's the first time I've ever heard her speak, but, there's a segue to this intersect, but about a year ago, when my son got signed by the Padres and he was going to go to, and he did go to spring training in Arizona, of course I went too, and Emily Gullickson, I think, lived in Scottsdale or somewhere near there, and I had actually reached out to her and I don't usually reach out to many people to meet, but I had always been intrigued by her on Twitter, and I'd actually reached out to her to meet so she could explain this whole plot thing of hers, in this, in what she does, and she said, "Oh, absolutely, we'll meet for coffee or something," and she'll explain the whole thing to me. But aside from that, I'd always been intrigued by her. As you pointed out, her Twitter handle was really, I always looked at it as Mayhem and then Emily, because she was quite a character on Twitter. At one point, was, I guess, a little more political than, the norm for Twitter, for people in the business, which it kind of attracted me to her. Since I think she's had to tone some stuff down because it's work, but at any rate, she was a really intriguing character. And I'd really first come across her name because there was a big article on Dink, the gambler.
Yeah, Alan Dinkinson.
Yeah, in Deadspin. And I had read that piece, and one of the things that Dink was doing when he was wagering a lot of money on racing was he utilized the services of this new young person in the business, and it ended up being Emily Gullickson. And there was a segment in there on some huge wagers that Dink made based on Emily's figures or whatever, her picks. Yeah. So that was a really interesting article, and I kind of put two and two together while I was on Twitter. Hey, I said, wait a minute, this is that same person,
Well, and that actually says a lot about Dink himself, too, who's a legend, that he, as with as much experience as he has in, in handicapping, and he's a sports bettor as well, prominently, that he is willing, and that's that's one of the reasons I like having these conversations, and frankly, it's also evidence, and I've said this very often, that the fact that John Doyle and John discussed optics, the origins of optics, right, early on when he won the NHC, and I remember having a conversation with him early on. Then you think about the Timeform product, and you think about the investments that Equibase has made and tried to innovate and create. I'm getting familiar with something we're going to feature: Form to Win from Australia. That is a a very effective, it's more speed oriented tool than any other element. But we're going to talk about Form to Win in coming weeks as well. There's so many people. If there was no market and if there was no potential and if the industry was supposedly on its last legs, then there wouldn't be all these people putting money and effort into products. And you know, then you think about what Jerry Brown does, constantly trying to improve Thoragraph. I mean, they're
oh yeah, yeah.
The form just made some innovations to Formulator that I got to get. I got to get Lonnie on and have him talk about. There's too much investment. I mean, think about what you do with work, and there's so much.
There are a lot of intriguing people in the business,
yeah.
Because you mentioned Timeform, and a lot of people don't notice, but one of the important guys in the development of Timeform, when it really started to get developed, was another Twitter figure known as O'Crunk.
Sure, Chris Rossi.
Yeah. And he was really, I still remember having, as a matter of fact, it just so happened, I spoke to him yesterday, just to catch up, but I still remember when he got hired over there, and, he's a self-taught guy in computer programming, and he did a lot of the heavy lifting of this thing that nobody really knows about. But you know, it's again another person in the business that you come to find these intriguing characters that come out of it.
No doubt on the character front, and that's been true. That's been true from probably even before there were PPs, Pittsburgh Phil era, and the old and the Speed Boys, right? The Speed Boys,
yeah. Jules Fink,
Julie Fink, exactly. Mm-hmm. And in fact, it's funny. I, next time I have this conversation with Andy, Andy was. We were talking, I don't even know how it came up. It was a Gulfstream oriented, and he was talking about 90s era Gulfstream.
Uh-huh.
And he said he was talking about three winters that in a row that he spent down there when he was playing full time. And So it's got to be like 94, 5, 6 in that range. And
yeah.
He mentioned some names, and some of them are names that have been, changed to, protect the not so innocent. Some of the characters, not that they were doing anything nefarious, but didn't necessarily want to be identified like by Andy Beyer, for instance, in the winning horse player or in any of the buyer, the buyers, buyer on speed or any of the books.
Yeah. I mean, Joel Fink, interestingly, the stable JFB stable, remember that?
Yeah.
Richard Santulli. Well, that was named after Joel Fink. He was one of the original partners in it with Richard Santulli. So talk about two guys that you would never have thought would be partners. But they apparently had met in their common attorney's waiting room, hit it off, and farmed a partnership. One guy, a gambler, and the other guy, ended up, becoming obviously a major breeder. An owner.
Sure. Now, it's a double-edged sword, Sid, to some degree. Tony, the conversations most frequently with Tony Black seem to, scratch this surface. It's a unusual scenario, really, with this game, because, and here's here, you know what? I've got the perfect analogy to make it easier to present. There was the 42nd Street, the Times Square era that you certainly, you know, being a New Yorker,
mm-hmm.
you remember, and there were people that were decrying the condition and the atmosphere and the seediness of Times Square and 42nd. So then we got this era of the, you know, the homogenization of 42nd Street and Times Square, and the you know, some people have called it the Disneyfication, and you know, suddenly it was clean and bright and safe and look how beautiful, and it all of its certain, you know, rough and tumble appeal disappeared, and the game. What lures people and what makes the game fun and unique and a throwback to a different era is some of the rough and tumble and the less than pristine. And so,
that's such a great example. That is a brilliant example of what we're talking about. And it's I told you I just happened to speak to Crunk, and that was actually one of the conversations that we had, was that there's this rogue element to this game that no matter what you try to do, no matter what disinfectant you spray on it, no matter what federal agencies you enact to get rid of drugs, there's this rogue element to the game that is going to be a part of it, whether you like it or not. And it's just, you know, that analogy is absolutely perfect because that explains it in a nutshell, you know.
I'd have to think that, I mean, a lot of what makes it what it is, people wouldn't want netted out, and I suppose it's because of the certain tone that the social media presentation offers, which is invariably negative, probably, you know, 3-1, probably 75% of stuff is grousing and you know cat kicking, but The things that people complain about, in a lot of ways, you know, are things that you know, when you read the bygone era, and you know, when you're reading Runyon and Red Smith columns, and watching the movies, I mean, it's what's so appealing about the game. So I don't know if you want to double wash it like spinach.
Yeah. No, you know, it's funny because there's a similar analogy that I can relate to. Years ago on Twitter, you know, Dink is on Twitter, and for some reason he and I ended up following each other, and suddenly it came out that I lived in Park Slope, and this guy started giving me the, you know, Sergeant Friday grilling. Where in Park Slope? That's 7th Street. Turns out he had lived in Park Slope on 8th Street, at 8th Ave. And there had, you know, there used to be a bookie over there. All booked all the bets in the neighborhood, right? And Dink knew him. My friend Duke Dossick, who was the managing editor of DRF, he lived in his neighborhood on 8th Street, too. He used to go to that bookie. And, you know, Dink started asking me if he was still, if the guy was still around or something. But that was part of the whitewashing, the gentrification of Park Slope, too, you know. Same thing happened, like, with Times Square. It changed. It got gentrified, and it is now what it is. But there was great history behind it, and part of it included, you know, some of this type of element that we're talking about that actually lent some charm to it, you know?
No doubt. No doubt. One of the funny things about the conversation I had to have with Andy, because he mentioned he was sort of free associating, and he brought up a name and he started to wonder aloud to himself. He goes, gosh, you know, I haven't heard from so-and-so. I hope he's still alive. I mean, I'll tell you one thing, Sid, that this crappy pandemic has done. It is going to break a chain in that regard. You know, one of the things that is most appealing about attending races and going places for meets, whether it's Del Mar, Saratoga, Keeneland, we just brought up Oaklawn, and you know, the people that have got rituals, you know, to go to certain weekends at whatever venue. You know, I've gone to about three or four of the last Risen Star weeks in New Orleans. You get into those habits, and I can also relate this to, you know, working Carolina Barbecue at Saratoga those 10 years, and, you know, certain people coming either every weekend or every Thursday or, you know, coming for 10 days. And one of the things that may not be so easily recaptured is, you know, those flows that, you know, are part of, you know, particularly the boutique venues and the seasonal venues.
Yeah.
Which will be sad. Yeah. I mean, if you know, the people that, you know, you're going to, you'll go whatever, you come to Saratoga, hopefully this summer, and you know, looking for somebody that you always have seen, and they're not going to be there. You know, this, you know, you hope so, but there's so many relationships that, you know, that are annual.
that's right. That's right.
That live in that realm. Well, before we talk, I promised at the opening of the show, Sid, there's a certain percentage of the audience that is counting on us, I think, with some thoughts. And then there's the group that'll criticize widely complain that we bring up this topic. But your thoughts this morning, we're not less than 90 minutes away from Joe Biden and Kamala Harris taking
the oaths. Well, you know, my thoughts are what I've been saying for the last 5 years. The only reason I stayed on Twitter for 5 years, and the only reason I changed my Twitter handle from, you know, Pedigrees or Racing Writer to Trump Critic, was I can't wait for this day. And this day didn't come quick enough, you know?
Yeah.
And I think, you know, there just needs to be a major change of tone in this country. Don't get me wrong. I mean, I'm friends with a lot of guys that were supporters of Trump, but we went into the Twilight Zone, you know, 4 years ago. And there's just a lightness to my step today, just because it just, like, we're the mothership has landed back on Earth after a horrific journey into outer space, you know. And so I just hope everybody can appreciate the moment. And, you know, those of you listening who weren't 2 weeks ago charging into the Capitol in Washington, I hope those of you with some semblance of, you know, reality and true patriotism and understanding of the Constitution realize that, you know, this peaceful transfer of power is what it's all about. And, you know, we continue hopefully into a newer, more peaceful, more sensitive era.
When you say sensitive, I made a comment last night on Facebook. I put up the picture of the really affecting picture of the field of flags representing the 400,000 dead citizens, and made the comment that, you know, we're on the eve of a you know, of a more compassionate America, ideally. And I, you know, you mentioned the, you know, ideologically, I mean, in terms of having debate or having, you know, the give and take that, you know, the political discourse is supposed to have in this country. I have no issue with you know, the alternating governance. I do have a problem with Nazis with with white supremacists. If you're happy to share thoughts and discuss the merits of traditional platforms of Democratic and Republican approaches to our society. The Pandora's box that has been opened here is so reprehensible and so vile that's what has driven me. And for the people who have said, you know, stick to racing and so forth, I'm sorry. I've said this, and you and I have had these discussions when the opportunity, you know, arises. And ideally, this is the last one for a while. I'm not going to sit quietly, and anybody that has any, you know, has any appreciation for history and has any real true affection for what this country, what the promise of this country is supposed to be, and of course that can be tied to Monday's holiday as well, you have to be vocal and you have to actively fight against a concept that, you know, produced the greatest conflict in human history in World War II. And I suppose the only thing that this has done is, I guess we're not going to have to travel to another continent to find the Nazis and root them out. I guess we're saved a trip abroad. I'm not on that topic. I'm not going to be quiet. And
thank you for not being quiet about it.
Yeah, I refuse. And you know, and the people that can't seem to understand and differentiate between BLM and what went on last summer, and what's been going on in this country for 200 years on that front, you're absolutely willfully blind. And you want to be fiscally responsible, and you're for limited government. Okay, fine. I'm fine. You want to fight against Medicare for all? Okay, that's fine. But there's not going to be any. There's not going to be unity with white supremacists and racists and Nazis.
That's
forget
right.
it.
Yeah,
you don't.
It.
There's no seat at the table for them.
Yeah, that's exactly right. No, I feel the exact same way. And, you know, like, as you know, I've certainly appreciated with the pulpit you have that you've gone against, you know, the tide and actually been outspoken and provided a platform. Actually, when I've been on here to speak about it, too.
Sure.
Also, you know, as you know, I left Twitter, and I told people I was leaving shortly after the election. It's like my son said, you took the W and left. Yeah, exactly right. Because, you know, that, to me, if you just stayed silent, and again, these aren't policy issues we're talking about, like you mentioned. These aren't, back and forth historical positions that people are debating. This is a completely different two-headed monster. And if you stayed silent, and, you know, I was so disappointed to see so many people do that, that I knew that I, on Twitter again, that really nice people, you know, I understand some, you know, people can't, everybody doesn't have the luxury, even if they wanted to speak, to say something. But to those that did, you know, I really appreciate it. You've got a lot of listeners. One guy in particular, Joe Hornman, I want to send a shout out to him. Great guy. He listens to us every week. You know, he was a guy that doesn't tweet a lot, but, you know, it's always just great to see people, you know, stand up for what's right. And, you know, and then you had a lot of people, unfortunately, that showed their hands too early, unfortunately.
Well, look toward and hope for, as always, the best. I'm not apologizing for anything. I'm involved here. I'm on the radio 250 days a year, and if people, I imagine that, you know, the terms of a personality or a, you know, a life, I mean, which I've been sharing for 15 years plus, I it's impossible for me not to, this is part of me that can't be, that I'm not going to allow it to be squelched. I'm sorry. If it's problematic and it makes you uncomfortable, I mean, that's what these kinds of conversations are meant to do in some degree. You know, hope you have enough respect for people like Sid and I to, you know, to acknowledge what we're trying to impart. So I appreciate Sid, you know, well, I appreciate the opportunity to get these, you know, get these out when we're together, because it's hard to, you know, it's not easy to sit and, you know, and just hold everything in. I mean, I have not seen my father, who's 91 years old. I've not seen him in over a year. And
you know, I'm the same way with my mom.
I mean, it's
same thing.
Yeah, I mean, it just. Yeah. And it didn't have to be this way. I mean, that's the part that is unsettling. And you know, then there's the matter of him at the beginning of the first 10 years of his life, and now, you know, not that he's got a foot in the grave, but he saw all of this in Vienna from 1929 to 1939.
Yeah.
So I have that as a, you know, as the foundation for my angst, if it, you want to describe it as such.
Exactly.
So, a couple of notes, Sid. Let's get into a couple of results, and also I should ask you your thoughts on the Eclipse finalists. We'll a week from tomorrow we'll have some answers, but any thoughts about the way this turned up?
It's something I just briefly looked at. What happens with these finalists? Are the finalists that they published the largest vote getters?
Those are the
And are they listed when we see them?
No,
Are they listed by? No, they're just
alphabetical.
Listed. Alphabetically, okay. So we don't know which one's wrong. Yeah. It was interesting that Monomoy Girl was a finalist for Horse of the Year, and so when I had originally read it, I thought this is odd that she was number three or something for Older Mare, but I get, you know, obviously it was erroneous on my part because it was just alphabetically listed and not not listed by points. So that's good. It seems like you know, I saw your thing. I thought you had a really great ballot. You know, there were some people that, as usual, you know, have some strange ones. I don't vote. When I was with Daily Racing Form, I did, and back then, as I've mentioned on the show before, there was a small committee that actually did the Breeder of the Year. I thought you had. Who did you have for Breeder?
I went fairly commercial with Godolphin, Calumet, and Windstar.
And for owner, I think you had Gary Barber, right?
Well, yeah, I I've been very vocal about this. I mean, I'm very.
He had seven Grade One winners, didn't he? I mean, he was a part of, you know, certainly he was a person that you highlighted that a lot of people didn't.
It's bizarre, and in fact, with some further research, he actually had 19, a total of 19 graded stake winners when you went even further beyond, you know, the major, as a standalone owner, and then in his partnerships, a total of seven Grade Ones, six Grade Twos, six Grade Threes. And I mean, it's at the very least, even if he wasn't going to, you know, win the polling and be acknowledged, he at least was a finalist. That the fact that he's not a finalist is
that's
astounding.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
those
are the kind of things that come out. You know, you have people that do some extra work that find that. And others that, you know, just look at the stats. Yeah, you know, some of these people, I read somewhere, maybe it was Andy Serling who said it, or I don't know. It sounds like a Serlingism, but some of these people have no business even voting. And judging by some ballots I saw, there was some questionable picks. But usually at the end of the day, you have enough knowledgeable people that are part of the pools, and, you know, hopefully the right people get and the right horses, you know, it falls the right way. And more often than not, that's the case.
Well, I we'll see how this turns out. But there's occasions where there's owners that, particularly the owner category, that deserve to be acknowledged when the opportunity comes. I mean, they're putting tremendous investment.
Gary Barber may never have another year like that again.
Exactly.
Well,
and last year, by all rights, if it wasn't, you know, if Seth Klarman wasn't as overdue as he was, and you know, the Bricks and Mortar, you know, puts him over the top and makes it, you know, just automatic that he finally gets acknowledged. I mean, he could have been identified as the Eclipse winner the previous 3 years. So last year Gary was worthy. It's tough. I mean, Mrs. Weber is somebody that, you know, when she's had the champions, you know, the milers that she seems to produce, the mayor produced repeatedly win approval, but you need to really, you know, show that the industry is cognizant of the kind of commitment that these people are showing to the game. And, you know, you talk about the committee. Jay Pribman has talked about how the quarter horse side, they have a 25 person committee that meets and argues and fleshes out their awards. And, you know, I don't know the quarter horse side as well, or nearly at all, but that sure feels, when it comes to the human side of this, it really feels like that might be worth exploring. You know, the voting on the horses gets it right invariably. I mean, there's some tough decisions. Like this year, I mean, Vekoma is probably going to fall short against Whitmore. And Vekoma could easily have been a sprint champion. It's not a stretch by any means. But it you know, the voting on horses seems to do the right thing 98% of the time.
Yeah.
We'll see.
A lot of times the breeders category, and that's why there was a committee for it, you know, a lot of people don't follow that segment as closely, but you're right. You know, the same thing could be said for owners too. And right, and these days, and this really came to light a few years ago with Saul Heumann, but what's been shown since the Saul Heumann attempt to get owner of the year, you know, there had been a kind of a campaign at that time to push him forward. But an offshoot of that, what's really come to light since then, is really the growing number of partnerships in the game for owners, right? So
yes.
This is a trend that's going forward, and it's going to have to be addressed by voters. It's not a game where you have single ownership entities as much anymore. And so this trend of partnerships, I think, means that the people that compile these stats are going to have to really break it down for voters to get a good glimpse of it. And your example of Gary Barber is one. He may have been the majority or a single ownership of some, but then when you break him down into what he had in others as well, it becomes, you know, even bigger, right?
Well, he's I can tell you that of the, is it? I wonder how many horses this is, because you know, some horses obviously win more than one stake. I mean, Vequist, you know, she won two Grade Ones and Channel Maker, and that's the other thing about this. You know, he's going to be part of two champions. I mean, so if you're using that as a method of evaluation, there's plenty of reason. So one, two, three.
Did he also own a part of Gretzky the Great?
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, that's going to be a Canadian champion. You know that, too.
That's true. That's a good point.
Yeah.
That's a good point. So 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 19 graded stake winners with wins with 13 different horses. And of the 13, he's the majority. He's the standalone owner or the majority owner in 11 of the 13.
Oh, wow. That's overwhelming. Overwhelming.
That was my point. And you didn't have to, you know, scrape and dig to see this.
Yeah,
I mean,
right.
Then there's all that. Well, and then, then there's the rank and file. Just the rank and file horses, that the hundreds of starters that he has in you know, his allowance horses and you know, he's got claimers that he runs. I mean, he starts a huge number of horses. It's very, in fact, I'm going to tell you, and I think these stats only go to December, early December, but total. Yeah, through December something, I think December 6th or 7th, he had started 357 runners, 357 starts total. I mean, that's a big number.
Yeah.
So.
Wow.
Sid, a couple of race result and Stallion too. Let's. I want to get that in, and I got to ask you about some thoughts on Midnight Bourbon, who I thought won well and was holding everybody safe in the LeCompte. Son, it is now.
Yeah, it's funny because every time I'm on your show, I get an idea for a column. And so, like, when I'm on your show and I say something, which I had, I think, when we were talking about Capo Kane, and then I turned that into a column. And it's funny you should mention Midnight Bourbon, because I was just thinking that he might be my next column.
Now, some top-line thoughts about this one. I mean, obviously, you know, the... It's amazing the Winchell operation. Between the font of Tappet and what is now going to be a steady supply of gun runners, but then to augment it with other products, it's formidable.
It is, and familiar silks every time you see them running. Yeah, I mean, it's amazing, as you say. This horse is by kids now. That's the other thing that I think is significant. Tis now, obviously we know he was he's no longer a stud. He was a horse that kind of made his own pedigree, and his dam made that pedigree. Song started to get a lot of success when Brett deceased Tizzy, his sire, who was only a stakes placed horse and a son of Relaunch. But, the significant thing we've mentioned on your show over and over is that line, Tis Now, is an American line that goes back to Man of War, straight back to Man of War. And in this age of so much Polaris blood, 95% of, if not higher, horses trace back to Polaris, and that comes through various sons of the major horses, from Nash Ruler to Native Dancer, Turn Two, all the lines that are big now trace back to him. So this is an anomaly, this line. And Tis Now really hasn't had a great son. And so I'm always hoping that the next big horse by Tis Now could be the Stallion, And it's one of those lines that you want to see continue to thrive. It adds diversity to the breed, and it's an important thing. You don't want, it's a mom and pop line in a way, competing against the mom and pop bookstore competing against Barnes and Noble and all the big chains, essentially. And we don't want all chains everywhere. We want, we want those mom and pop shops, and that's Tis Now and his line. So that takes care of that sire line. The female line of this horse is also particularly American. It's a real American line, all the way back to the founding dam, and it's again another line that's not populated by a lot of huge horses in it. And that's another interesting thing. It's kind of line that you would love to isolate certain stallions in it. It's right up your alley, horses that aren't big names. And I'm talking about horses, like Prince of Ascot and Speedy Frank, Count Speed, a lot of stallions like that on the female line of this stallion. And there's one particularly interesting part to this line, and that is the second band, Catch My Fancy, is inbred 3x2, very close, on what's known as the Rasmussen factor to the mare Monique Rene. And Monique Rene is the modern part of the family that's led to a lot of stakes winners. John Franks helped make the family quite a big name. A lot of horses in recent times kind of descend to this mare, Monique Rene. And the second dam, Catch My Fancy, who was bred by John Franks, is inbred 3x2 to that mare. There's a lot of, you know, interesting pedigree elements to it. Monique Rene's daughter, Clever Monique, of course, produced Yes, It's True. You know, who is an excellent sprinter. And this family, by the way, is also the family of another recent retiree, Chancelot, who's at Buck Pond Farm. Monique Rene is in the direct female line of him as well. Yeah. So the dam, of course, her first four living foals are all graded stakes winners. One by Colonel John, one by Tale of a Caddy, who was the grade one winner, Gervin. One by Shanghai Bobby, who's also the sire of Chancelot. So another member of this family was bred to Shanghai Bobby at the same time the dam of this horse was, and both of them produced graded stakes winners. And, of course, the fourth horse is this horse here. Stone Street owns his mare. They bought her for $240,000. And, you know, what a gem she's been when you have your first four living foals all turn into graded stakes winners. It's no wonder that Winchell had to pay $525 for the horse.
The Monique Rene portion of this, Sid, I got to ask you about that second dam, Catch My Fancy, that Frank's bred. Mm-hmm. That is awfully close up to take a daughter of Monique Rene.
That's what I'm telling you about.
How unusual is that to have done that? I mean, I don't think I can think of anybody that I've seen it that, you know, that close up.
It's you know, it's the Rasmussen factor of inbreeding to a superior female, you know, through different individuals. And it is extremely close. It's very rare. When we've talked about the family of Liam's Map, we've mentioned it too. You know, it's John, you know, Leon Ross. Leon, you know, this was something that Leon had. That's why it's called the Rasmussen factor. It's really something that he brought to light that people did. If you want to know about the specifics of this particular mare, John Franks, you know, is credited as the breeder of Catch My Fancy. But the guy that really orchestrated this mating was Dan Kenny, who was John Frank's kind of bloodstock advisor. And Dan was a great guy. He was a great writer too. And, you know, a jack of all trades. And, you know, every time I would be in Lexington, I'd meet Dan at Dudley's. And Dan would always quiz me about Leon because he knew I was such great friends with Leon. And so, you know, Dan died a few years ago, so I can't 100% say Dan did it, but I'm 99.9% sure that that's why, you know, John Franks wasn't going to do this on his own. It was Dan. Now, if you look at Clever Monique, the dam of Yes, It's True, there are a lot of pedigree type of people that were associated with this in a way. Clever Monique, that mare, Les Brinsfield, the pedigree guy, wanted that mare for George Wagner. And so that's George Wagner's credited as the breeder of Yes, It's True, but the Mayor Sog and Folta, is it true for 16,000 at FEMA in November in full? And that was Johnny Jones, Soledad mayor. Les Brinsfield was George Wagner's pedigree advisor. And so, yes, it's true, was bred by George Wagner. And, you know, funnily enough, Alan Porter and I, you know, Alan Porter, the pedigree expert, and I, a few years later, sold Clever Monique on behalf of George Wagner to Becky Thomas.
Huh. That sequel.
So, yeah, so it's just funny, the number of Alan, myself, Les Brinsfield, Dan Kenny, the specter of Leon Rasmussen. A lot of us were tangentially involved in the family. And the family, by the way, goes back deeper to three generations of Rex Ellsworth mayors that Rex Ellsworth bred in California. So there's a lot of interesting things, and you can see why I was thinking about writing about this.
Nice.
Because, yeah, it's that close inbreeding that you point out, that is rare, and that's extremely close, 3x2.
She produced 17 foals. 17.
Yeah. And, now, if you have your and we've mentioned this on this show before, but if you have your computer up, look at the second dam of Liam's map, which is Yada Yada by Great Above. She's 2x3 to Tawi.
Wow. Wow.
See that?
I'm now, pulling it up now.
Yeah, yeah. Pull that up, yep. And I'm going to show you something here. The breeder of that horse, or the co-breeder, is Brian J. Howlett.
Right.
Brian Howlett was John Nerud's man and came up under John. And then eventually became manager of Tartan himself. John Nerud, at this stage of the game, right before this, had contacted Leon Rasmussen to help him do some matings for Fappiano. I've mentioned this on the show before. And one of the matings that Leon and John worked on was the pedigree of Quiet American. And I'd like you to bring up his pedigree right now, if you can. And I want to show you a similar profile. If you bring up his pedigree,
Dr. Fager.
You see that he's inbred 3x2 to Dr. Fager, which is a stallion. But look at the female line, Sequillo.
Sequillo.
4x3 to Sequillo.
Yep.
So John started to do that kind of stuff based on his conversations with Leon. And then later, Brian Howlett on his own did what he had learned from John with Yada Yada. Dan Kenny was intrigued by this and decided to do that with Monique Rene for John Frank. And that's why that one was 3x2. Alan Porter and I ended up selling Clever Monique Rene's daughter to Becky Thomas. And this mare has now ended up, this line has ended up with Stone Street. And, you know, ironically, it's, and of course, Les Springsteen, who was a great pedigree guy too, was enamored by this mare. And, you know, it's just so ironic that, like I said, we've all kind of been real familiar with this mare and in some cases actually been, you know, involved in its development at some point.
Pretty cool.
Yeah.
Well, and of course, working it back to Yes, It's True, that ties in our man Satish. And
I was just going to say that. Yeah.
Yeah.
The teeth. Yeah, and actually, it even goes further than that because there's some other horses too. But you know, George Wagner actually the farm that he used where this horse, yes, it's true, was foaled, was the old Tom Gentry farm. And Tom Gentry, of course, bred a bunch of horses that Dwayne Lucas raced. And I think there were some others that Satish was a part of that came from that same land. So it's interesting that that land of Tom Gentry produced was the ground where Yes It's True was foaled. And Yes It's True, of course, ended up with Lucas for Satish. And, you know, it's a continuation of land in that case as well.
Well, I know people are you know saying that that you know, Midnight Bourbon isn't necessarily you know that as the distances stretch. I thought that he was holding you know the oncomer you know the oncoming proxy and Mandaloon. It seemed like whenever anybody came to him, he you know let out another notch, Joe Talamo, and they never. You know, they closed, but he maintained, and I'd be anxious to see. Kind of a decent enough next step from a figure, you know, from a speed standpoint. So,
what kind of fire did he get?
93, I want to say 93. I believe.
Good.
No, 90. Actually, 91. 91. So a little bit lower than I thought.
Yeah, 90s are pretty good. You know, and of course, let's not forget that he beat. Some highly touted horses in that race too, you know.
Well, Mandaloon was taking crazy money. I mean, in fact, we talked about this yesterday with Andy. I didn't 3 to 5 was lunacy. And maybe some horses, you know, kind of got exposed out of this. But hey, that's what this is about. That's the whole point of there being a prep season. So
And also Mandaloon probably had that. Sentimental factor of Judmont and Brad. Little,
that's a good point. That's a good point.
You know, and everybody touting the horse from the guy at TDN who does his Derby Dozen to Chris McGraw writing a big article about him on the eve of the race. You know, I don't know. I thought it was crazy as well.
Well, we'll see. We'll see who takes, if there's anybody in this future wager. Ed DeRosa is going to join us next, and we're going to talk about the horses that jumped in to the next round of Derby future wagering. And there are a couple of interesting, including that proxy who was second in the LeCompte, who's by Tappet out of Panty Raid. Pretty fancy pedigree, but. Starting to get going, and there was even more stuff, Sid, but I'll save it, and full 45 with you, and I appreciate it, as always. And again, we remind everybody, especially with babies dropping now on a regular basis, work Thoroughbred Consultants, 510-490-1111. That number again, 510-490-1111, and whether you're going to wait and see how your foal looks, and then make your final decisions. Either way, you should be in contact with Sid and the team and get.
All right. Well, I appreciate it. And we'll talk next week. I'm going to put a couple of hot dogs on and put the TV on.
There you go for the action at noon. Sid Fernando, everybody. Sid, I appreciate it.
Thank you, Steve. Bye.
Sid Fernando. Let's take a break. 15 in hour 3, and Ed DeRosa, as mentioned, we'll look at the future wagers, and he sent me the Briz PPs. I printed those out, and we can touch on that, and we'll see what else. See what it was Ed's birthday yesterday, so we got to see how his birthday went, right? And Seth Merrill later. I want to get there's a good maiden race at Tampa today. There's a turf race. The 8th, going a mile on the grass, and mostly firsters. There happens to be a Godolphin homebred in here. There's only two horses that have run, inside, outside. I'll check to see if there's scratches, but Low Country, the one for Godolphin and Stidham, and then on the outside, Stone Street with the horse that's moved to Christoph, a Sea to Stars colt that had a couple of runs over the summer when Wesley Ward had him. The right stuff. But everybody else is a firster, including one for Mrs. Thayer, for Stella Thayer, who, of course, owns Tampa. Sam's son in here. Actually, Graham Motion has got Dance Some Mo, an Uncle Mo out of Dance Again. Dance Again, she sold last week in the dispersal sale. Back after this, Ed DeRosa at the races.
The latest racing news. It's At the Races with Steve Vick on Sirius XM Radio.
Horsebills.com is a cost-effective, time-saving, paperless revolution. Vendors are able to generate electronic invoices for owners and other vendors who can pay through Horsebills.com for just 50 cents. Turn hours of work into minutes with our easy-to-use site. Have our team take over your bookkeeping or continue to do it yourself and pay only our low monthly subscription fee. Check out our video tutorial on the Horsebills.com YouTube channel and get started today for free. Horsebills.com. Toll-free number 888-938-4643.
Why, in the past decade, has BRL Equine become the premier equine supplement company in the industry? Because we spend millions in research and development before we ever put out a product. Because we use only FDA-supervised facilities to manufacture for us. Because what we say is in them is in them. Because they work. Because if you're not happy, I'll give you your money back. And because top trainers and veterinarians in thoroughbred racing, standardbred racing, three-day eventing, and barrel racing all trust in BRL Equine. Shouldn't you? To find out more how Flexify HA, Unlock, Bleeder Shield, and EPO Equine can help you, contact me, Joseph Vellante, 215-501-6880.
A great story to tell in Pennsylvania. Only three states have produced more Breeders' Cup champions, and no state can match our performance in recent years. Since 2016, our numbers of